So that was one of my first jobs. And that's what I'm all about. You and I've talked about it. It's called analogous thinking. It's taking a solution from another problem that you've solved in the past and reapplying it to what outwardly appears to be very different. But if you're good at pattern recognition, you'll see these matches.
Welcome to the Manufacture Houston podcast, where Houston's manufacturers come to share, learn, and grow. Brought to you by Alchemy Industrial. For more information, check out alchemyindustrial.com.
On today's episode of the Manufacture Houston podcast, we talked to Dan Alford with ARC Specialties. Dan is one of the pioneers of robotics and their applications in the industrial world. I'm sure you will love today's episode with Dan.
Well, Dan, welcome to the podcast. I'm really excited to see you. How are you? Happy New Year.
Thanks for having me on. I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah, so you and I got to visit a couple of months ago, I think, for the first time, and we both totally geeked out on all the amazing stuff that you're building over at your business. And so we'll get to all that, but before we get to it, why don't you just give us an introduction of you, who you are, and what you guys do every day, and then we'll jump right in.
If you don't mind, I'll start all the way back in the middle 70s when I was in high school. So I was one of the early computer geeks. There weren't any PCs. The only place you could play with a computer was a mainframe. The only way you could communicate with a mainframe is you had to build an acoustically coupled modem, which is what we did. And then we were using a teletype because, you know, back then you didn't have a CRT. That was too advanced. So we happened to have the password for one of the university's computers. One of my friend's father had a password and it was all above board, but so we would dial in and actually use the mainframe in the 70s. And so in order to communicate with a computer back then, you had to be able to type, you know, it was still pretty much the case. So I'd take typing classes. So it was me and a bunch of girls in typing class. It was a target rich environment. And I learned the necessary skills to operate the keyboard. Fast forward to, you know, get through college. And I'm pretty good on industrial stuff, particularly welding. So if you combine a computer geek with welding, back in 1980, that's as close as you can get to a roboticist. So that intrigued me, and that's how I got into robots. Is you got to combine the industrial technologies with software, and I happen to have that odd combination of skills.
Mm-hmm. And you told me about one of the very first things, very first problems that you had solved. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, first I went to work for Hughes Tool. That was a fascinating place. I went to work there just after Howard Hughes had passed away, but a tremendous amount of technology in that company. And, you know, we were welding with electron beams way back in the 70s and computer control stuff. So I got to learn from a lot of brilliant people there. And then, you know, one of the early things my boss asked me to go build a machine to take apart horizontal drilling machines. There's a fellow that's got a horizontal boring company. Well, we were doing it back in the 70s. So you got these big horizontal boring machines. And my boss named Eric Sullivan, he asked me to go build a machine to remove the grease in the ball bearings, to disassemble these horizontal boring cutters. I think he was just trying to get rid of me for a few days. I went down there and into the lab. Got something working, went up to his office, said, "Hey, Eric, it's running." He was kind of surprised. He said, we went down there and it ran. He said, "How'd you know how to do this?" I said, "Well, I built one when I was a kid." And I said, he said, "You built a bearing machine?" I said, "No, I built a flamethrower." And they're almost identical. And so, because you're pumping flammable solvents through. So that was one of my first jobs. And that's what I'm all about. You and I've talked about it. It's called analogous thinking. It's taking a solution from another problem that you've solved in the past and reapplying it to what outwardly appears to be very different. But if you're good at pattern recognition, you'll see these matches.
How did that assignment turn out? Did you screw it up or did you get it done?
No, it was, you know, like I said, it wasn't that hard. You just have to take apart these things, you got to remove the grease in the balls. And so really it was just a matter of pumping flammable solvent through there. And so I knew how to do that. And that worked well. And then I started ARC Specialties about 3 years later. One of the first jobs was a hot tap at a plutonium plant in Idaho. Fortunately, I think that's the only one we got. There's a smokestack up there. It's about 8 foot in diameter. They wanted to weld a T into them. It's called a hot tap because they didn't want to shut the plant down. So we had to drill through 4 foot of concrete, slide an 8-inch pipe up against this 8-foot wall. And then we wanted to weld the pipe in, but you know, you can't weld the outside of the pipe like you would normally because it's covered with concrete, right? Mm-hmm. So we had to reach inside the pipe, you know, 6 or 8 feet in and make that weld. And then we had to cut the wall out. And so what I was 23 years old. And I think if the government had known it was a kid in his garage, they might not have reacted well, but they didn't know and it worked great. And, so made the radioactive tap up there, and so then I was off to the races. Never looked back. I figured if I could handle a plutonium hot tap, we could do some other stuff too.
For sure. How did they even find you to do that kind of work? So this was obviously before the internet and LinkedIn and all this other stuff, YouTube. So how did they know that you actually existed out there that you could do this kind of work?
Well, my whole career, I benefited from knowing some brilliant people. And there's one of my mentors is a fellow named Jeff Post. He passed away about 2 years ago. But if you happen to look in the front of the American Welding Society Structural Welding Code, his name's in there. He's one of the authors and he's been a mentor forever. But, you know, he's another 10 years older than me. You know, I'm kind of the first generation geek, computer geeks from the 70s. Right. So when he grew up, he didn't have that opportunity. So anytime Jeff got an interesting project that required motion control servos, computers, things like that, he brought me in. And so he was working with me on that project. It's interesting. 10 years later, we went back and did the same job again on the same stack.
How did you know Jeff? Had you worked with him before?
Well, he and I used to build jackup rigs. And a jackup rig, they're pretty much obsolete now, but back when oil was in shallow water off the coast, you had a boat that actually had legs that would extend and then it would lift itself off the bottom of the ocean. And then you drill an oil well. I think they were good to 250, 250 feet. You know, nowadays they're drilling off of drill ships, right? But there's a lot of technology in a jackup rig. We were using HY-100 steel, and that's the same thing they use for submarine hulls. It's challenging to weld. And so Jeff and I were the guys that built all the automated welding equipment to weld this submarine steel and build these jackup rigs. So he taught me a huge amount.
So that was back I hate to say it, like 40 years ago when you did that plutonium welding job. So from that day, give us a bit of history on how things progressed for you and for Off Specialties as you sort of moved beyond that initial job that you did.
Well, the way that most robots are integrated in America and across the world is the robot companies don't do the final integration, right? What they want to do is they build the arms. And so that between them and the end user is something called a systems integrator, because when a robot comes from the factory, they don't have any tooling at the end of the arm. They don't have any way to hold the part. They don't have a welding torch, a cutting torch, a screwdriver, or, you know, whatever we're trying to automate. And so my goal in life had always been to work for a systems integrator. And right while I finished up at UH in the early 80s, a company came to Houston called Automaker, and they were doing robot integration for Cincinnati Millicron, Daewoo, and a few of the other early robot lines, which are, you know, no longer in business. And so I was excited. I wanted a job there, managed to get one, and worked there for several years. Typically integrators, it's not atypical for an integrator to fail. Most of them do. It's a tough, tough world, and they failed. And when they did, I started Arc Specialties, and, you know, knock on wood, I've been running Arc Specialties full time since 1990.
Oh, that's great. So bring us to today. We'd love to hear about some of the work that your company is doing today. What kind of projects do you guys work on?
That's the fun part, is because technology constantly advances. Processors are getting quicker. New sensor systems are becoming available. All this stuff combines. And so, for example, like digital signal processors were invented to convert music into, you know, digital data. So you can carry it around in an iPod or whatever. But what that is you're converting analog to digital and digital back to analog. And so what we've done in industry is we've got to do the same thing for motion control. And so we're having to convert a lot of analog data to digital and then back. And so we're using this for motion control. We're using it for welding machine control. My point is we take commercial technology and then apply it to robots and allows us to do new things. We're starting to do 3D vision systems now, and that was commercial technology, but allows robots to, at a glance, not only measure X and Y, but also Z dimensions. So that's been the fun part for me is constantly watching for new technologies, new sensor systems, and then going back and applying it to problems that we weren't able to solve in the not too distant past. We've got a good one right now where robots are putting in bolts. Okay. You know, that's no big deal, except these bolts weigh 70 pounds. They're torqued to 20,000 foot pounds torque. So that's like having a wrench a mile long and pushing on it with 4 pounds. That's huge, huge numbers. And so the robots obviously can't handle that kind of torque. So the robot uses a torquing tool to do this. And it has a reaction arm that that takes that torque. Well, what that means is we don't really know where that tool is going to be. And up until a few years ago, we didn't have the technology to soft servo. Now we're soft servoing so the robot can actually float in one or more axes. And so what this allows it to do is when the tool moves, it doesn't damage the robot's gearboxes. So that's a trivial example, but it was huge because it was the enabling technology on this bolting project.
So what do you think is driving what seems to be an increased interest in automation in the industrial world? What are the kinds of things that are driving the interest from customers? What problems are they trying to solve today that they perhaps were not thinking about solving a few years ago?
Well, I'm going to go back to when I got out of school, the 80s. So back then, I think it was 30% of our gross domestic product was manufacturing and 10% was financial services. By the, by 2010, that had flopped. Most of our financial services were up to 30 and manufacturing is down to 10%. Well, you see what that caused. That was created a lot of problems because there's only a few segments of our society that actually create wealth. That's manufacturing, mining, farming. And the rest of them just redistribute it. So, to create a strong economy, manufacturing is one of those three. And so I think people have realized that you can't pass money back and forth and create anything. So we're seeing a manufacturing renaissance in America. This whole COVID thing has also shown everybody the vulnerability of supply chains when they're reaching across the world. So we're seeing a lot of reshoring. And at the same time, I go all the way back down to the high school level. It's cool to build stuff again. We're seeing maker spaces right here in Houston and all over the place. We're seeing high school robotics competitions where the kids are encouraged to design and build stuff. So it's a great time to be in robotics, because of the logistics, because it's part of the economy that actually creates wealth and jobs. So it's a good time to be a roboticist.
And I know that you and your company have done some work with schools. Tell us about what you're doing now with encouraging some of this thinking with school age kids.
Well, it's funny. This week I was out in the field country, hill country in Central Texas at a very small school. The whole town only has 400 people. I went through there. Just before Christmas. I like to walk through schools, and I said, hey. Your program here, you don't have anything but shielded metal arc welding. You need other welding processes to teach these kids. And so I donated a welder and I taught the teachers and about half of the kids to TIG weld on Monday. And, it was just a taste of it, but I left the machines there and I also dropped off a guided bend tester. That's the fun part for me working with these rural schools is because they really appreciate your help, and they need it. But in town, I do it a little differently. Here in Houston, we work with the schools for those high school robotics competitions. So I've started school teams at Yates High in Houston, Bel Air High, Bruny, Texas, down on the border. I started one at Hogg Middle School, Duchenne, and Memorial High. So those are all teams I started. And it's a great program. I'm a huge advocate for this because the kids have to design and build robots. And if they fail to do it within the time constraints, then they stare at their dead robot while all the other kids have fun. So it really is a motivator. And nowadays, when I hire engineers, I look for US first on resumes, because if a kid has gone through US first robotics, that means they've actually had to build something with their hands. And all my engineers that work for me at Arc Specialties, they're hands-on. You know, they get paid too much to build a machine, but when they're in Samara, Russia, they're going to have to be able to spin a wrench, solder a wire, retype a line of code themselves. So I'm a huge advocate of people that are versatile and able to work with their hands. And this high school robotics program is a good beginning for them.
So I'm curious about this. When you show up in a school for the first time and you're in front of a group of kids and maybe haven't even thought about robotics or making anything, what are the kinds of reactions or responses that you initially get? Are they sort of standoffish, or are they all in, or something in between?
It's been so much fun because each school has different needs. When I was working at Yates, this is a very poor inner city school. The kids were unfamiliar with how to build things. One kid asked me, "How do you dig a hole in metal?" They were they literally didn't know how to drill a hole, and that's fine, you know. And so, but they were eager, and we was the very first year I ever did this. Was 2000. My kids beat the NASA team, right? And so, you know, they went from not knowing how to dig a hole in metal to beating NASA. We actually took the NASA team to the finals. The way it works is the top eight teams pick from the loser column, and since NASA had paid our way, we did that. So that was one team. I worked with the kids at Memorial High, and they were great on computers. I didn't have to teach them to code, but once again, they weren't familiar with industrial techniques. And I worked with some kids on the Texas border, very hands-on, absolutely able to drill holes, weld, and all that stuff, but they'd never written code. So it really depends on my audience, but I'm versatile enough, you know, I could handle any of them. So I just fill in as necessary, and my goal is to spread the joy of robotics and fill in as needed.
Well, that's amazing. I think you're right that we certainly need to find different ways to engage young people, because by the time they graduate from high school or graduate from college, it's tough to sort of infuse the joy of manufacturing into them at that point. So we've got to begin earlier. I did a podcast that we'll release soon with Harry Mosier, who talks a lot about reshoring. And one of the statistics that he talked about was that if only 10% of what we currently offshore comes back to the US, we'll need 2 to 3 million manufacturing jobs. And it's really, and that sounds great, and it is great, but it's a big concern in terms of creating a manufacturing pipeline of people that can actually make stuff. It doesn't seem like we've invested very much in that as a country. What are your thoughts on just overall the presence of manufacturing talent or the lack thereof? What do you see in the industry?
No, it's a huge problem. I like the way Europe does it better. You know, where you have an apprenticeship program, and here we're lacking that. And so I think the community colleges are doing a fair job of it. And I think the stigma of community colleges is dropping away. So, you know, kids are going there and they're learning a lot of hands-on skills there. And that's what I push, is if you start with the hands-on skills, and then if you can continue with that, maybe you can get an associate's degree. And if you're still enjoying it, you keep going and get a bachelor's degree. You know, there's no end to it. But I like that because there's intermediate steps. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so worst case scenario, you become a skilled craftsperson and you make a good living, you know, sure. Welding, machining, wiring, something like that. Or you build upon this. And I've actually had arguments with some of the principals at the schools. They said they didn't want to stigmatize the kids into blue-collar labor. I said, whoa, time out, hang on. I said, all my engineers are capable blue-collar laborers, and they're also engineers. So right. There is some pushback out there, and we don't have a good way to train kids, but I think we're getting better with more high school programs and like I said, the community colleges.
I think you're right, Dan, that a lot of it, there is sort of a stigma or a lack of understanding of what it really means to be a skilled blue collar worker. And as you very well know, today, that is not what it was 20, 30 years ago. It's a very different type of person. So if you were describing sort of a career in as a blue collar employee, a maker of some kind, without a college degree, to, and you were describing that to a young person, how would you describe that career? What kinds of things will they get to learn? Will they get to do? What kind of skills would they develop?
Well, I guess you got to pick a vector. What I do is kids need a vector, right? And so I'll take high schoolers in and take a couple every summer, and then they shadow. And so they'll shadow a mechanical engineer, electrical engineer, software engineer, welding engineer, and material scientist. And then they go out and shadow welders, shadow machinists, shadow mechanics, because so many kids, you know, they see what mom does, see what dad does, and they see TV, but they don't understand all the different options. But once you get that vector, you know, and you decide you want to do mechanics or electronics or whatever, and then you can pursue it, and you can make a great life on it, out of it, and you can also build upon it. You know, you can go for that, you know, further education, associates or a bachelor's degree.
Yeah, that's right. I think you're right that it's one of those areas where you're not going to stop learning how to do new things. And as technology continues to evolve, then you'll learn that too. Case in point, something like 3D printing, where not very many people were talking about 3D printing a decade or so ago. But today it's just now becoming sort of a fundamental skill set. And as 3D printing technology evolves, then you have an opportunity to learn that. And you don't need a college degree to be really effective in operating some of these new technologies that are developing, manufacturing technologies.
I get a lot of kids coming in, and you know they're excited about 3D printing. I said, how old is this technology? And they go, oh, you know, it's new. And I said, well, you know, let's get back to my point of analogous thinking. In reality, welders have been doing additive manufacturing for over 100 years. Sure. And so we build a lot of additive machines. You know, they're all, you know, one-offs at this point. But I've got them running all over the place, and they're doing additive manufacturing in metals, and it's nothing but robotic welding. And so if you were a skilled craftsperson in welding, that is the enabling technology for additive metal manufacturing. They call it WAM, a wire arc additive manufacturing. You know, 15 years ago, we'd call it MIG welding.
Right, right. Yeah, it's amazing. I think a lot of it is just sort of explaining how to build on these different technologies and skill sets over time. So let's sort of move as we wrap up our conversation, Dan, let's move into the future. So as you're thinking about, let's say, the next 5 years, for not just your company, but our region and our country more broadly, what do you hope happens? And what kind of changes do you hope come into being over the next 5 years?
Well, I hope that the robots take over the dull, dirty, dangerous jobs, and the humans, you know, that it frees us from the dull, dirty, dangerous, allows us to do other things. You know, in agriculture, that's the earliest automation success story. 50% of America worked on the farm in the year 1900, now less than 2%. And yet nobody says they'd want to be walking behind a mule plowing the field. So robots are nothing but labor-saving devices. They don't take the good jobs. They take the dull, dirty, dangerous jobs. And I think what's interesting for me is if you go back to 1960s, what was the first computerized manufacturing automation? It was machining. Okay. So that's the highest skill level job. And only now am I tackling some of what would be considered lower skill level jobs. And I find that kind of interesting to think about. You know, I'm picking up bolts and threading them in. Okay. You know, the guy that does that is not considered to be the craftsman that the machinist was. And yet it's taken us 40 years to go from doing the machining to doing the bolting. And that's because some of these other tasks, which are seemingly simpler, require a great deal of adaptive control. And adaptive control means the world ain't perfect. We don't know where the bolts are. We don't know where the holes are. And so this requires much more sensor technology. And I think that the new sensors and the faster processors will allow us to tackle some of these would be traditionally considered to be a lower skill job, like sanding or polishing. Robots are starting to do that because they now have a sense of touch. So I think that's what we're going to be doing is taking some of those dull, dirty, dangerous, repetitious jobs and automating them, reshoring the manufacturing here. You know, made in America is a good thing.
Yeah, well, it's certainly going to be an exciting time for the next 5 years. So Dan, tell us How can people get in touch with you, get in touch with your company?
Go to the website, www.arcspecialties.com, A-R-C-S-P-E-C-I-L-T-I-E-S. We post a whole lot of videos on our additive and various projects we're doing. So you can find us on YouTube, but you can get that from our website too. And we're right here in Houston, Texas. We have a lab up in Ohio, and we've got machines installed in 32 countries around the world.
Pretty incredible. Well, Dan, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it. We'll add some of the information on your company in the show notes so people can easily click on that information. And for anyone that's listening that really wants to listen, learn about robotics and what Dan is doing, give him a shout. It really is like Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory out there. There's some really interesting things to learn. So Dan, thanks again for your time. Really enjoyed our time together, and I'm looking forward to seeing you soon.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Take care.
This has been the Manufacture Houston podcast, brought to you by Alchemy Industrial. For more information, check out alchemyindustrial.com. If you'd like to be on the show or want to recommend someone to get on the show, just reach out to me on LinkedIn. M-U-S-H-K-H-A-N. Mushkan. I look forward to hearing from you.